Chapter 24. Heard of anything? Oh, not a party, I think, said an inexperienced young Farish who had arrived late. I put her in her cab as I was coming in, and she gave the driver the trainer's address.
The trainer's?
Exclaimed Mrs. Jack Stepney. Why, the house is closed. Judy telephoned me from Bellomont this evening.
Did she?
That's queer. I'm sure I'm not mistaken. Well, come now, Trainer's there, anyhow. Well, the fact is, I've no head for numbers, he broke off, admonished by the nudge of an adjoining foot, and the smile that circled the room. In its unpleasant light, Selden had risen and was shaking hands with his hostess. The air of the place stifled him, and he wondered why he had stayed in it so long. On the doorstep he stood still, remembering a phrase of Lily's. It seems to me, you spend a good deal of time in the element you disapprove of. Well, what had brought him there, but the quest of her? It was her element, not his. But he would lift her out of it, take her beyond. That beyond. On her letter was like a cry for rescue. He knew that Persis's task is not done, when he has loosed Andromeda's chains, for her limbs are numb with bondage, and she cannot rise and walk, but clings to him with dragging arms as he beats back, to land with his burden. Well, he had strength for both. It was her weakness which had put the strength in him. It was not, alas, a clean rush of waves they had to win through, but a clogging morass of old associations and habits, and for the moment its vapors were in his throat. But he would see clearer, breathe freer in her presence. She was at once the dead weight at his breast, and the spar which should float them to safety. He smiled at the whirl of metaphor with which he was trying to build up a defense against the influences of the last hour. It was pitiable that he, who knew the mixed motives on which social judgments depend, should still feel himself so swayed by them. How could he lift Lily to a freer vision of life, if his own view of her was to be colored by any mind in which he saw her reflected? The moral oppression had produced a physical craving for air, and he strode on, opening his lungs to the reverberating coldness of the night. At the corner of Fifth Avenue, Van Alstyne hailed him with an offer of company.
Walking?
A good thing to blow the smoke out of one's head. Now that women have taken to tobacco, we live in a bath of nicotine. It would be a curious thing to study the effect of cigarettes on the relation of the sexes. Smoke is almost as great a solvent as divorce. Both tend to obscure the moral issue. Nothing could have been less consonant with Selden's mood than Van Alstyne's after-dinner aphorisms, but as long as the latter confined himself to generalities, his listener's nerves were in control. Happily, Van Alstyne prided himself on his summing up of social aspects, and with Selden for audience was eager to show the sureness of his touch. Mrs. Fisher lived in an east side street near the park, and as the two men walked down Fifth Avenue, the new architectural developments of that versatile thoroughfare invited Van Alstyne's comment. That Craner house, now a typical rung in the social ladder. The man who built it came from a milieu where all the dishes are put on the table at once. His facade is a complete architectural meal. If he had omitted a style, his friends might have thought the money had given out. Not a bad purchase for Rosedale, though. Attracts attention, and awes the western sightseer. By and by he'll get out of that phase, and want something that the crowd will pass, and the few pause before. Especially if he marries my clever cousin, Selden dashed in with the query colon and the Wellington Brise. Rather clever of its kind, don't you think? They were just beneath the wide white facade, with its rich restraint of line, which suggested the clever corseting of a redundant figure. That's the next stage. The desire to imply that one has been to Europe, and has a standard. I'm sure Mrs. Bry thinks her house a copy of the Trianon. In America, every marble house with gilt furniture is thought to be a copy of the Trianon. What a clever chap that architect is, though how he takes his client's measure. He has put the whole of Mrs. Bry in his use of the composite order. Now for the Trainer's, you remember, he chose the Corinthian. Exuberant, but based on the best precedent, The trainer house is one of his best things. Doesn't look like a banqueting hall turned inside out. I hear Mrs. Trainer wants to build out a new ballroom, and that divergence from Gus on that point keeps her at Bellomont. The dimensions of the bride's ballroom must rankle. You may be sure she knows them as well as if she'd been there last night with a yard measure. Who said she was in town, by the way? That fairish boy? She isn't, I know. Mrs. Stepney was right. The house is dark, you see. I suppose Gus lives in the back. He had halted opposite the trainer's comer, and Selden perforce stayed his steps also. The house loomed obscure and uninhabited. Only an oblong gleam above the door spoke of provisional occupancy. They've bought the house at the back. It gives them 150 feet in the side street. There's where the ballroom's to be, with a gallery connecting it. Billiard room and so on above. I suggested changing the entrance, and carrying the drawing room across the whole Fifth Avenue front. You see, the front door corresponds with the windows. The walking stick which Van Alstyne swung in demonstration dropped to a startled allo. As the door opened and two figures were seen silhouetted against the hall light. At the same moment a hansom halted at the curbstone, and one of the figures floated down to it in a haze of evening draperies, while the other, black and bulky, remained persistently projected against the light. For an immeasurable second the two spectators of the incident were silent, then the house door closed, the hansom rolled off, and the whole scene slipped by, as if with the turn of a stereopticon. Van Alstyne dropped his eyeglass with a low whistle. Ahem, nothing of this, eh, Selden? As one of the family, I know I may count on you. Appearances are deceptive, and Fifth Avenue is so imperfectly lighted. Good night, said Selden, turning sharply down the side street without seeing the other's extended hand. Alone with her cousin's kiss, Gertie stared upon her thoughts. He had kissed her before, but not with another woman on his lips. If he had spared her, that she could have drowned quietly, welcoming the dark flood as it submerged her. But now the flood was shot through with glory, and it was harder to drown at sunrise than in darkness. Gertie hid her face from the light, but it pierced to the crannies of her soul. As he had been so contented, life had seemed so simple and sufficient, why had he come to trouble her with new hopes? And Lily, her best friend. Womanlike, she accused the woman. Perhaps, had it not been for Lily, her fond imagining might have become truth. Selden had always liked her, had understood and sympathized with the modest independence of her life. He, who had the reputation of weighing all things in the nice balance of fastidious perceptions, had been uncritical and simple in his view of her. His cleverness had never overawed her, because as he had felt at home in his heart. And now she was thrust out, and the door barred against her by Lily's hand. Lily, for whose admission there she herself had pleaded. The situation was lighted up by a dreary flash of irony. She knew Selden. She saw how the force of her faith in Lily must have helped to dispel his hesitations. She remembered, too, how Lily had talked of him. She saw herself bringing the two together, making them known to each other. On Selden's part, no doubt, the wound inflicted was inconscient. He had never guessed her foolish secret, but Lily must have known. When, in such matters, are a woman's perceptions at fault? And if she knew, then as he had deliberately despoiled her friend, and in mere wantonness of power, since, even to Gertie's suddenly flaming jealousy, it seemed incredible that Lily should wish to be Selden's wife. Lily might be incapable of marrying for money, but she was equally incapable of living without it, and Selden's eager investigations into the small economies of housekeeping made him appear to Gertie as tragically duped as herself. She remained long in her sitting room, where the embers were crumbling to cold gray, and the lamp paled under its gay shade. Just beneath it stood the photograph of Lily Bart, looking out imperially on the cheap gimcracks, the cramped furniture of the little room. Could Selden picture her in such an interior? Gertie felt the poverty, the insignificance of her surroundings. She beheld her life as it must appear to Lily. and the cruelty of Lily's judgment smote upon her memory. She saw that as he addressed her idol with attributes of her own making, when had Lily ever really felt, or pitied, or understood? All she wanted was the taste of new experiences. She seemed like some cruel creature experimenting in a laboratory. The pink-faced clock drummed out another hour, and Gertie rose with a start. As he had an appointment early the next morning with a district visitor on the east side. She put out her lamp, covered the fire, and went into her bedroom to undress. In a little glass above her dressing table she saw her face reflected against the shadows of the room, and tears blotted the reflection. What right had she to dream the dreams of loveliness? A dull face invited a dull fate. She cried quietly as she undressed, laying aside her clothes with her habitual precision, setting everything in order for the next day, when the old life must be taken up, as though there had been no break in its routine. Her servant did not come till 8 o'clock, and she prepared her own tea tray, and placed it beside the bed. Then she locked the door of the flat, extinguished her light and lay down. But on her bed sleep would not come, and she lay face to face with the fact that she hated Lily Bart. It closed with her in the darkness like some formless evil, to be blindly grappled with. Reason, judgment, renunciation, all the same daylight forces, were beaten back in the sharp struggle for self-preservation. She wanted happiness P171 greater than wanted it as fiercely and unscrupulously as Lily did, but without Lily's power of obtaining it. And in her conscious impotence she lay shivering, and hated her friend. A ring at the doorbell caught her to her feet. She struck a light and stood startled, listening. For a moment her heart beat incoherently, then she felt the sobering touch of fact, and remembered that such calls were not unknown in her charitable work. She flung on her dressing gown to answer the summons, and unlocking her door, confronted the shining vision of Lily Bart. Gertie's first movement was one of revulsion. She shrank back, as though Lily's presence flashed too sudden a light upon her misery. Then she heard her name in a cry, had a glimpse of her friend's face, and felt herself caught and clung to. "Lily, what is it?" she exclaimed. Miss Bart released her, and stood breathing brokenly, like one who has gained shelter after a long flight. "I was so cold I couldn't go home. Have you a fire?" Gertie's compassionate instincts, responding to the swift call of habit, swept aside all her reluctances. Lily was simply someone who needed help for what reason, there was no time to pause and conjecture. Disciplined sympathy checked the wonder on Gertie's lips, and made her draw her friend silently into the sitting room, unseat her by the darkened hearth. "There is kindling wood here. The fire will burn in a minute." She knelt down, and the flame leapt under her rapid hands. It flashed strangely through the tears which still blurred her eyes, and smote on the white ruin of Lily's face. The girls looked at each other in silence, then Lily repeated, "Colin, I couldn't go home." "No, no, you came here, dear. You're cold and tired, sit quiet, and I'll make you some tea." Gertie had unconsciously adopted the soothing note of her trade. All personal feeling was merged in the sense of ministry, and experience had taught her that the bleeding must be stayed before the wound is probed. Lily sat quiet, leaning to the fire. The clatter of cups behind her soothed her as familiar noises hush a child whom silence has kept wakeful. But when Gertie stood at her side with the tea she pushed it away, and turned an estranged eye on the familiar room. "I came here because I couldn't bear to be alone," she said. Gertie set down the cup and knelt beside her. "Lily, something has happened, can't you tell me? I couldn't bear to lie awake in my room till morning. I hate my room and Aunt Julia, so I came here." She stirred suddenly, broke from her apathy, and dug to Gertie in a fresh burst of fear. "Oh, Gertie, the Furies. You know the noise of their wings alone, at night, in the dark? But you don't know there is nothing to make the dark dreadful to you." The words, flashing back on Gertie's last hours, struck from her a faint derisive murmur. But Lily, in the blaze of her own misery, was blinded to everything outside it. "You'll let me stay?" I shan't mind when daylight comes. Is it late? Is the night nearly over? It must be awful to be sleepless. Everything stands by the bed and stares. Miss Farish caught her straying hands. El Lily, look at me. Something has happened, an accident? You have been frightened. What has frightened you? Tell me if you can a word or two, so that I can help you. Lily shook her head. I am not frightened. That's not the word. Can you imagine looking into your glass some morning and seeing a disfigurement, some hideous change that has come to you while you slept? Well, I seem to myself like that. I can't bear to see myself in my own thoughts. I hate ugliness. You know I've always turned from it, but I can't explain to you. You wouldn't understand. She lifted her head and her eyes fell on the clock. How long the night is. And I know I shan't sleep tomorrow. Someone told me my father used to lie sleepless and think of horrors. And he was not wicked, only unfortunate, and I see now how he must have suffered, lying alone with his thoughts. But I am bad, a bad girl. All my thoughts are bad. I have always had bad people about me. Is that any excuse? I thought I could manage my own life. I was proud, but now I'm on their level. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.